Okay, today is March 1st, 2017. This is an interview with Ron Harris. We are here as part of the Academic Staff Institute inside Union South on the UW-Madison campus. And my name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Ron, to help us with sound quality, could you say your name and spell your last name?
My name is Ron Harris, H-A-R-R-I-S.
Perfect. Ron, first off, thank you for agreeing to meet with me today and have this oral history done. I gave you questions in advance, so I'm just going to go through those questions. The first is a two-part question, so I'm just going to ask it one at a time.
Okay.
And so that first question is, what brought you to UW-Madison?
And that's a two-part answer. I came to the UW-Madison two times. In 1989, I came to the UW as a part-time student, and 2000, I came as a part-time employee. I should tell you a little bit. So my prior career, I was an accountant. I'm a certified public accountant, and I was working for a large agribusiness company, and they in 1989, they transferred me from Indianapolis to our plant in Madison, Wisconsin. And that's how I came to Madison. I came to the university because in those days, in the evenings, I was signing up for college classes at whatever the local university was, partly for intellectual interest, something to do. But also, doing that, you get a library card, you get union membership, you get a gym membership, you get invited to concerts and things like that. In fact, at some point in there, I was a member of the university's cricket club. I was the only Anglo member. Everybody else was either from South Asia or from South Asian descent. They thought that was kind of I was a novelty. Mm-hmm. And so during that time, over a few years, I realized that what I was doing at night and on weekends was much more exciting than what I was doing during the daytime in my accounting job. And I talked my way into a PhD program at the university in English. In those days, you could still do that. I wasn't the only CPA in our PhD program. And over a several-year period, I went from being an accountant to an English professor. So in 1996, I moved to Hammond, Louisiana, to take up a job as an English professor, where my wife, who I met at the university here, was working as an English professor. And so we did that for a while. And then in 2000, she had a job offer at the University of Wisconsin at Whitewater. And we realized that was a way for us to come back to Wisconsin, which we both love. And so I came to the English department and said, do you need any classes taught? And of course they did. They had some freshman composition classes they needed taught on a temporary basis. Mm-hmm. And a lovely woman named Joyce Melville had taught in the English department for many years and was very ill. She was dying of cancer. But she would hold out hope that I can teach this semester. I can teach this semester. And a week before, of course, she'd realize I'm not up to this. And so for a while, I was teaching her courses as well on a part-time basis. And then eventually during a reorganization of the English department, we created a position, I wasn't involved, called Instructional Coordinator. And that's the position I hold now. And that came around in about 2000. So in both cases, I was going from part-time to full-time at the university.
I don't know if anybody else, future generations, is going to want to know this, but how did you become interested enough in cricket to join the cricket club?
I was, what I'm interested in doing is exploring campus and wandering around campus. And I happened to be wandering through McLean Center one evening, and I saw these guys playing cricket, and they said, hey, why don't you join us? And so I did. Turns out most of them aren't very good at throwing and catching, and I was a baseball player, so of course I was a real standout with that. But then they would just laugh at me when I was trying to defend my wicket, because defending a wicket is a very different thing than hitting a baseball. And I wasn't very good at it. So
thank you. So I think you sort of answered this, but I'm going to ask it directly anyway, and that's the factors that led to your work interest or to the job that you have.
Well, the thing, the job I have now actually combines some of both the accounting work and business work and the academic work I do. About two-thirds of my job is administrative, and it's very hands-on academic administration, working with people who teach classes, and then the other third of the job is teaching classes. So I teach in the fall. I teach freshmen, and in the spring I typically teach graduating seniors. And so I'm kind of combining both of those. But I think with the administrative work, having an academic background counts a lot. It gives me credibility with the people I work with, but it also gives me a much better understanding of what their interests are. And so I'm better able to read what they're telling me and translate that into, okay, how about if we arrange things in a particular kind of way? The way I talk about business strategies with English professors, I have to be careful because I need to use their language. Mm-hmm. A few years ago, we were having a meeting and trying to decide, can we afford to do something? It's a very basic cost accounting problem. And it was a curricular question. And so what I did was I did some real quick jotting. Susan Friedman, who was sitting next to me, watched me. And I said, the short answer is yes, we can afford it. She just shook her head and said, you know, I trust Ron, I like Ron, I hired Ron, but I just don't believe it. And she was right, because I was using the language and nomenclature of cost accounting, and that wasn't her language. And so I had to go back and I had to explain it in a different way so that not just Susan, but the other English professors would understand why the answer was yes, we can afford it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you for that anecdote.
Yeah.
So the next question is, so when asked, how do you describe what you do?
So, well, I think I told you I've got the two parts of my job. But in my role of, in the English department, we call instructional coordinator. Basically what I do is I manage the department's instructional mission. And that kind of includes two parts. So what that means is that we're offering the range of classes that students need and want to take. And that's at all levels, from general education courses to courses for majors to courses for graduate students. And also that we have qualified instructors to teach those classes. So that means I'm working with about 200 other employees. I'm working with, most of those are graduate teaching assistants, but I'm also working with academic staff employees. I'm working with faculty members who all have a variety of different goals and interests. And so how do we set the curriculum for the year, for example? You know, there's certain courses we have to offer, certain courses we would like to offer. How do we schedule the classes? If our faculty had their way, all of our classes would be Tuesday and Thursday at 11 and 1. That's just not feasible for a lot of different reasons. You know, that's not how students need to access our classes. So it's a matter of, you know, helping people understand that in order to meet their goals, we need to spread the teaching day out. And in fact, one of the things that we're trying to do is to reclaim Monday, Wednesday, and Friday classes, which is quickly disappearing on our campus. And then I also need to assign instructors to classes, particularly graduate assistants. And that can be fraught because quite often our graduate assistants are focused on very narrowly on what their interests are, and I need to help them step back and look at a bigger picture in terms of what skills can we help you develop through these teaching opportunities. And then there's also quite often a matter of hiring instructors every year, quite often on an emergency basis. Mm-hmm. So it's, but again, it's working with lots of other people to meet these goals.
So it's interesting that you started back here your second time being sort of, it sounded like maybe an emergency hire for a class, and now that's your job, is to help, if you will, put out those fires
when
they occur.
That's right.
Do they occur every semester?
Often it's not, yes. And they happen for a number of different reasons. We might have somebody who quits at the last moment or takes a sick leave at the last moment. You don't count on those kinds of things. The dean might call over and say, we've got too many, we have access problems at SOAR. Can you open a section of a particular course? And we always do our very best to say yes, because we know that if the dean's office is calling us, they've got a severe problem, and we want to be part of the solution.
Ron, you sort of answered this when, but I always like to ask questions directly just to see how they go. So the second part of that question was, what tasks comprise a typical day, with typical in quotes, meaning that I know there's really no such thing.
I guess I would take that a different way, is how do I organize my day? And typically, the way I do this is in the morning is private time, in the afternoon is public time. So in the morning, that's when I tend to do my reading, my preparation, my research. And much of the work I do, administrative work I do, requires reading and preparation and research too. So it's not all just preparing for classes. So I do a lot of the writing in that time. And then in the afternoon is public time. That's when most of the English department meetings are. That's when I'm working in my office and people can come find me to talk about problems. That's when I meet with students. So I'd say that's more how that works. In terms of a typical day, it really has more to do with seasonal, cyclical kinds of work that are set by other people. You know, when we do our scheduling of classes, we're working on the registrar's schedule. The registrar says, here are the times when you need to do certain activities. That's when we do those kinds of activities. The dean's office gives us directives. We want this report on this day. Well, that's what governs the work we do in the month leading up to that kind of deadline.
So, Ron, you mentioned public time and being in the office. Mm-hmm. Where is your office and the follow-up business? Has that changed during the course of your time here?
Yeah, my office is in Helen C. Whitehall on the 7th floor, looking out over Lake Mendota. Three of the four sides of the building look out over Lake Mendota. The fourth side looks over Bascom Hill, so there's not a bad view in the whole building. And my office has been in that location for, I think, 12, 13 years. We reclaimed a conference room a few years ago and moved the associate chair's office into the suite that the department chair holds. We used to be on a different floor, and so there was a big disconnect in terms of communication quite often. Mm.
So it sounds like that was a change that helped the logistics of the department.
Yes, we made some physical changes that allowed us to communicate much better. Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to ask this both since you were here as a part-time student in the late 80s, but the bulk of it is your time here.
Yeah.
I'm always interested in how people think about the technology changes and how they change their work. So the specific question is, how has the change in the technology changed your work?
Well, a better way to put that is that changing technology created the need for the job I now hold. The job I hold now, a generation ago, would have been done by our associate chair. And what the associate chair and his or her assistant would do is write down on a piece of paper, here's the schedule, and then send that over to the registrar's office, and the registrar would code that some way. In the 1990s, with the Integrated Student Information System, which is now called SIS, all of a sudden that work got put out to individual units, and the registrar's office said, you just enter it directly and you take charge of maintaining this. Lots of other kinds of information went out that way. You know, that's when WISDOM was developed. That was when DARS was developed. That was when DARS exceptions went online. So these are all different kinds of computer operating systems that require a fair amount of training and learning. And we were to the point where our faculty simply said, that's not how I want to spend my time, right? That's not the best use of my time. And the English department said, you know, we should take the tasks that require a steep learning curve and place that in a single position where we'll have stability for a long period of time, so that we can simply develop that expertise and maintain it. And so that was what brought on the creation of my job.
Okay. And so that happened soon-ish after you came back to teach?
That was going on in, probably about the time I returned. I wasn't part of that conversation. Again, I was an adjunct instructor. English department chair, Susan Friedman, was pushing this as part of a larger kind of reorganization. And when the English department advertised the job, our department manager, Kathy Dock, said, Ron, here's this job. You should apply for it. It fits a lot of the kinds of skills that you seem to have. And so that's how I ended up in this position.
Okay.
There were a number of other applicants for the job.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've been back since 2000.
Yes.
And since 2000, we've had email.
Yes.
But I always am interested in how that mode of communication possibly affected your work?
Well, email means that a lot of business that we used to take care of by telephone is now electronic, because it's often much easier and quicker and more efficient to put something in three sentences than try to explain on the telephone. So a lot of work can be done that way. But I'd say with email, it isn't just having email, it's how does one access email? Because now, with the wireless communication technologies, I can access email from any place. And from doing that, well, for example, last night, one of our program directors said, we're having some questions about funding one of our positions. Can we set enrollment to close enrollment in one of our fall classes for the time being? Rather than having to come to my office and do that, which is what I would have had to do 15 years ago, I was simply able to, right then, go into the timetable, close enrollment in that particular class, and write back and say, it's done. So it was a much more efficient use of my time. In fact, I was thinking about this. 15 years ago, I was on campus and in my office just about every day of the week, including weekends. Mm-hmm. So I was working 3 to 4 Saturdays a week and usually 1 or 2 Sundays a week. And largely it was because I didn't have access to the technology at home. I'm still doing that work on weekends, but I don't necessarily have to come to my office in order to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm on campus for other things. I'm at the library, or I'm at the surf, or the union, or the theater, something like that. But I don't necessarily have to be working in my office on those days.
And it sounds like for your example, or for your situation, it was certainly a benefit. In my situation, I don't work a lot from home on the weekends.
Okay.
So the idea of having wireless means that people might think I'm accessible.
Yeah.
But it sounds like for you, you were doing the work anyway.
Yes.
It does is it just has helped you almost exponentially. Or at least maybe not exponentially, but it allows you to stay at home instead of having the commute back and
forth. I can stay at home. I can do that work at the library. You know, I can do it wherever I happen to be.
Right.
And here's the other thing. With our new email system that we put in 2-3 years ago, I can save an enormous number of files. That actually becomes a searchable database for what did I promise, or what did that person ask, or when did that person contact me. I've always done that. I've always saved my email to my desktop computer for that purpose. Mm-hmm. But that's much easier now. I can search things out at home.
So, Ron, since I don't know this for sure, I have to ask a pretty closed question, which is, were you or have you been involved in academic staff governance or groups?
I have. And I think four ways. Since about 2005, I had to look. In 2005, I joined the Academic Staff Mentoring Committee. That was during the time when we went from being housed in the Associate Provost's Office, or the Provost's Office, to being housed in the Academic Staff Assembly. I'll tell about more about that in a minute. My experience with that got me interested in the Human Resource Design Project, and I worked on one of the work teams with Human Resources Design. I've served on the University Library Committee for several years, and I learned quite a bit there, because the library was doing a study on how to reduce the physical footprint of the library. In other words, how do we move from a library system that's based on housing print materials to a library system that's based on helping researchers get information that they need? And which turned out to be a little controversy, because it scared people. And so one of my jobs was to help the librarians explain what they were doing and why to the academic staff governance groups. And of course, librarians are members of the academic staff, so they were very, very interested in this as not a research issue, but as a workplace issue. And then currently I'm working on an ad hoc group studying salary compression ahead of a large UW system-wide total compensation and benefits review. But the Academic Staff Mentoring Committee, I became involved in that when a man named Jim Ferris, who worked for the Communication Arts Program at that time, called me and he said, would you like to serve on this? And he was calling me because in those days, to get off of the committee, you had to find a replacement. And I went to talk to Betsy Drain, I'd never heard of it. Betsy Drain was our associate chair. Turns out she had been the vice provost for faculty and staff when the committee was formed. Mm. She had a certain vision for what that would do. I'm not sure how that played out, but she encouraged me. She said, "Oh yes, that's a worthwhile activity. You should take that up." And I did. And what I discovered was we didn't really have a good focus in terms of who we were trying to serve. But a good, it became pretty clear who we could serve that we weren't serving very well. And that was brand new professional employees, most of them recent college graduates, who needed to learn the conventions of professional life. You know, they were still acting like college students in many respects, and it was causing problems for them in the workplace. And so, number one, that's how do we help newer employees become professionals. But the other challenge was for more seasoned professionals who came to the university from working in private industry. They were feeling very frustrated by kind of the way we work, and they felt like it was really slow and they weren't being valued. Troy, a good question to ask employees who've been in that situation is, tell me about the first time you tried to buy something at the university. And boy, do they go off to the races, because if you've worked for a smaller outfit, you don't have purchasing agents. You just go buy stuff. And now all of a sudden, there's state purchasing regulations, which, by the way, are probably good things, right? At the university, we have a special fiduciary responsibility to the taxpayers of Wisconsin to use funds in particular kinds of ways. And once I think the older employees, or not the older employees, the more advanced employees, started to realize, oh, this is why I'm having to go through what they would call jumping hoops to purchase things. Mm-hmm. There's also a better understanding of, oh, here's the bigger picture that I'm working in at the university, and how I thought I was working as a marketing director. What I'm really doing is I'm a marketing director in service of this larger mm-hmm. responsibility or larger service mm-hmm. To the people of Wisconsin. And so those really became the way we decided we should focus the committee. And at the time, we were refocusing our mission statement, we also approached the Donna Silver, who was then the secretary of the academic staff, and worked with her to get our committee taken into, I believe we're now a standing committee of the academic staff assembly. And so we went from being kind of an ad hoc group that met on the side to something that's more central to the academic staff governance situation. And that also gave us access to many more people, because now the nominating committee goes and finds individuals for us. So when my term ended, I didn't have to find a replacement. I simply, my term was up and somebody else came and started doing some of that important work.
Thank you for that, Ron.
Yeah.
So you talked about the mentoring. You talked a little bit more about the University Library Committee. Mm-hmm. These other two things you mentioned, both the HR redesign and the current ad hoc group, is there any more that you want to elaborate on either of those?
No, I think the ad hoc group is still in, we're still working, so we will submit our report shortly.
Okay.
And the HR design was really interesting because I got to meet people from very different places in the university. So I was there as a representative of the academic staff. There were other people who were representing human resources department. They were people of what was in classified staff. And so it was very interesting to work with people who I would never have had occasion to meet, but who in the years since I've run into quite often in context that often surprises. Happily. We're happily surprised.
Mm-hmm. So the next question, and it's a broad question, mm-hmm. but since I'm academic staff, you're academic mm-hmm. staff, I wonder if you think about the relationship between academic staff and faculty.
I do. Not in an abstract way, though, but because I live in an academic department that's dominated, really, by faculty, that's part of my job, is thinking about those kinds of relations. And I should say that, from my perspective, my sense of faculty is that they tend to see their relationship to their academic department as one of ownership. So they act very much like the partners in the CPA firm I used to work in, right? Mm-hmm. This is a proprietary relationship. This is our department. We own it, and they actually do own the intellectual content, right? They own the discipline, mm-hmm. right? That's the case. And I think that in the English department, that works out really well for everybody, because when they're thinking of that ownership, they're not thinking of, I want to do what I want to do. They're thinking, what is going to be the best for our department? How do we make decisions in ways that are going to be the best? What that means is that I can have some influence in that, right? And one of the things I do is to try to help people step back and look at the big picture, right? So details matter, but what's really interesting is when you step back from the big picture, the details that matter are might not be the ones you think matter initially, right? And so that's getting the faculty refocused quite often from a disciplinary, scholarly take on a question to step back and think, oh, well, how does this work in a larger managerial kind of context so that I can still do the thing that's important for me in my disciplinary context? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what I've been able to do. And one of the reasons I can do this is because part of the reorganization in 2002 opened up a lot of our governance structure in the English department. So prior to 2002, almost all the governance was run through the executive committee, which was only tenured professors. And what Susan said is that's silly. There are lots of other people in the English department who are making major contributions. Our junior faculty, for example. So the junior faculty now attend those meetings. She identified about a half a dozen academic staff employees and said, these are people who are making key decisions in our department. They need to know what we're talking about so that they can do their jobs. And so they've invited those of us who aren't legally members of the executive committee to attend and vote as advisory members. And that's most of that happened before my time, but I can't imagine what my job would be like if I were trying to make decisions in a vacuum, not knowing what the conversations were going on in the English department. So from my perspective, this has been a very, very positive working environment.
So I didn't write this question down, but I thought about it between... So on this campus, staff means academic staff and what used to be classified, but now university staff. So I wonder, in your situation, do you work with university staff?
Yes, I work closely with university staff in the English department. Brenda Weiss is our curricular representative, what used to be the tax representative. And she actually manages on a day-to-day basis our curriculum in ISIS. And she's usually the first line of inquiry for our graduate teaching assistants, because she and I operate as a de facto personnel office for our graduate assistants. And so we work very closely together. And then, I work with, we have, I believe, 13 university staff members in the English department. And through my work in curriculum, I work with probably half of them on a daily basis.
Were they able to, when this change in 2002 happened, were they able to have a voice in those meetings?
Yes. The department manager was one of the six people, or seven or whatever, who was invited to attend the meetings. And it wasn't the individual. It was by virtue of the office. You know, the manager needs to know what kinds of things people are talking about. What we haven't done, now in those days, what was then the classified staff had their voice through their labor union. What we have not done in the English department is figure out a way to bring those voices into our governance structure, the university staff voices into our governance structure. I don't know if anybody's asked the university staff employees whether they want to have such a voice. They might not. It might simply be that the kinds of issues that the executive committee are talking about just aren't of interest to them. I don't know. But I don't think anybody's asked. Mm.
So moving on. So you came back in 2000. As a historian, I always am interested in how people, memories of events that are... not just local, but national or global. Sure. So you know this question's coming. So your memories of September 11th, 2001. And as I say in the follow-up, either they could be professional or personal or both.
Well, I can tell you what I was doing when I heard about the what a student came in and reported was a plane wreck. I was teaching technical writing in the engineering school. And some students came in, class started at 9, a few students straggled in late and said a plane had crashed into a building in New York. And I thought to myself, well, you know, small planes crash. You know, it's probably not that big of a deal. And so I went ahead and we had our lesson on whatever it was. And I don't know what the various students knew, if they had any idea that what the magnitude, well, none of us had any knowledge of the magnitude of the event at 9 o'clock. And so about 10:30, I went back to my office where one of my colleagues was setting up a television set. I said, Steve, what are you doing? Haven't you heard? And so he turned it on just in time for the second airplane to crash into the Twin Towers. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, this really is a big deal. And of course, I spent the rest of the day sitting and just, like everybody else in the country, just watching events play out. The funny thing is, I thought to myself, my 3-year-old daughter was at daycare. I think, oh, should I go get my 3-year-old daughter? You know, and I realized, oh, she's playing. She's having a good time. She's completely insulated from this. Just let her be, because nothing good's going to come from picking her up. And that turned out to be right, because the next day she asked me, can we watch Building Fall Down? I thought, oh my gosh. So I had to turn the television off. And I thought, this isn't the kind of, you know, thing I want to be impressed upon her. And a lot of other people must have had that same impression, because what public television stopped running news programs about then, and they went to all children's programming 24 hours. And so you knew, and it wasn't just the kids who were watching, adults were watching it too, right? Watching Elmo was a big, big break from watching the terrible news that was coming out, even for a week after the attack.
Do you recall what changes it had, and maybe it didn't for you professionally, but what changes in then happened on campus because of 9/11?
Yes. What I noticed were barriers started going up around campus. For example, the Kohl Center, immediately some concrete bunkers went up on the front lawn, which used to slope up from the sidewalk up toward the Kohl Center. Some concrete bunkers went up, and then later that summer they put in a retaining wall to create a permanent barrier that would keep somebody from, driving into the Kohl Center. And I saw lots of landscaping changes like that that were clearly geared toward how do we protect against our buildings being attacked.
Okay. Thank you.
In fact, they didn't put concrete bunkers. They parked buses in front of the Kohl Center. That was the initial barrier, was parking buses. And then a few days later, the temporary concrete barriers came up.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah. I'd forgotten about that.
All right, so we are getting towards the end here. So I want to ask now, I mean, the reason why you came onto our radar is that you won an academic staff award. So I wonder if you could tell the story from your obvious point of view about the academic staff award you earned.
Sure. So when my colleagues told me they were nominating me, I was of course honored and humbled, right? Because I just think I'm just doing my job along with everyone else. And I came to think, well, I'm grateful that they're, how would I put it, that people are noticing and appreciating, if you will, the guy who oils the machine. Because what I'm doing is very much back office kinds of work that you don't get attention for doing generally. And I thought, oh, this is really nice because people are appreciating that work. And then I thought, well, what they're really doing when we have these kinds of, what we are really doing when we have these kinds of awards is we are celebrating our success as a larger organization, right? We're very high performing. The University of Wisconsin is very high performing. The English department is very high performing. And what the awards allow us to do is to recognize the efforts that all of us are making to make this a great university. You know, I was looking at, you'd asked about another award I'd won, an early career award I'd won. And I was looking through the list of people who'd won that, and there were many English department colleagues who'd won that award. And I realized that that's really one of the things we do, is we nominate people for the award as a way of recognizing that we're a high-performing unit, and allows us to reflect on it. Just last month, I nominated, prepared a nomination packet for Karen Redfield for an award, advising award. She's doing a fantastic job as an advisor, and helping the English department work in lots of other kinds of ways. And that nomination allows us to reflect on that.
Do you remember the thoughts or reactions you heard when you actually won?
I can't remember. The Anya Vonner, who had prepared the nomination, told me that I had won, but I don't remember much.
And then did you go to the reception?
Yes, I did go to the reception. And it was interesting for a couple of reasons. First, I was able to meet Martha Casey, who, of course, endowed the Martha Casey Award. And I think she's an interesting figure because she's a chemist by training but spent most of her career at the university basically creating what we now think of as institutional research. And I thought it was interesting how she took all the analytic skills she developed as a chemist and brought that to bear on data that we really hadn't paid much attention to, or maybe even gathering data that we'd never tried to gather before. And so now, instead of making decisions in a vacuum, as in, well, this ought to be, instead we're able to look and say, well, what's the data? What's the information? Is this really making a difference? Is there really a need for a program for change? And I was quite taken with it. And I was also very happy that I was able to spend a few minutes talking to Chancellor Blank about the Freshman Interest Group program, something that I'm very excited about at the university. And she knows about the FIGS program, but it was an opportunity to kind of remind her this is an important program, not just for students, for freshmen, but for the instructors at the university as well. Mm-hmm. In fact, we in the English department now have enough people who are teaching FIGS on a regular basis. I want to say 12 to 15, not every year, but 12 to 15 people, that we're now taking things we learn from our FIG classes and bringing them into the rest of our curriculum. And that's something nobody really ever expected to happen.
Right. And I think you said it first, but just to make sure we go acronym to English, FIG means First Year Interest
Group. Freshman Interest Group.
Okay. And have you taught a FIG, or do you just oversee the classes?
Yeah, I've taught a FIG for maybe a dozen years now.
Okay.
In collaboration with Classics and ILS. So it's a FIG that's geared towards students who are interested in English or history or some aspect of humanities.
Go ahead.
Well, just one of the things that we do is we have them take Latin. So the myth is what draws them in. But we also have the students taking Latin because we know that students who have Latin, even if it's only a semester or a year, can study literature and history in a way that those without Latin can't. There's just access to a whole different way of thinking about the documents and of our civilization.
So you already talked about the award you won as an early career award. So I think we're now to the, unless there are other things you want to say.
Is something interesting about that. So I was actually a little surprised to be nominated for an early career award because at the time I was 45 years old and I didn't think of myself as being particularly early career. And I think that speaks to how we at the university tend to be a little inward looking sometimes. So the criteria are so many years of higher in the position or something like that. And so the fact that I was 45 years old and I thought of myself as very much mid-career, I was being nominated for something that seemed a little unusual.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the last question is a two-part.
Mm-hmm.
So a legacy question. So what do you feel you'll be remembered for, and is that what you want to be remembered for?
So we're talking about the administrative work I'm doing, and largely that was why I was nominated for an award. What's really interesting is the people who are going to remember me most don't know I do that work. Mm-hmm. So the people who remember me most are probably the students, the FIG students, who are in my class, and because I'm one of the first people they meet when they start college. Quite often, my myth and literature class is their very first college class. And what they're going to remember is, again, they don't even have any idea that I do administrative work. They have their own concerns. And what they're going to remember, I think, is that my class helps them address those concerns that they have and that they rightly have. Let me tell you what the first assignment is. So it's myth and literature. They think they're signing up for Greek gods and goddesses, and we do get to that. But the myths we start off with are the myths of our campus. You know, we meet in humanities building. So the first thing the students do after they find their classroom is collect stories from other classmates about the humanities building. And then we share them on the first day of class, and they're all surprised. Why does everybody have a story about this? Oh, I guess we have a story about this because we belong to the University of Wisconsin, you know, and everybody has a story. Who's been here for the last 40 years has a story about humanities building. And having experienced the building, they understand why those stories are so unusual. We move out from there to look to other places. You know, what other places on campus do you know stories about? And the students are going out, and they're scouting around. They're talking to upperclassmen. They're talking to alumni. They're talking to parents about what stories do you have about this place. And they're often contradictory, you know, as mythology works. And so we're using those stories to build an idea of what myth does in culture. But the students are also finding that, oh, I know all these stories. I know all these places on campus. There's a place for me on this campus. And that's one of the big fears that students have when they come is, will I make friends? Will they make their friends in the fig? Will I fit in? And they start to fit in because, you know, the friendships they're making in the fig class, but also they're able to see themselves on this large physical campus and say, yes, there's a place for me. So years from now, when students are telling these stories, even stories they didn't collect in my class, that's one of the things they'll remember. Oh, yeah, this is where I learned these kinds of stories. And I think it's a really powerful way for students to connect to a very large campus that can seem impersonal. That's what students are going to remember. And what's really interesting is the folks who nominated me for the award don't fully know about that part of my work. They're kind of separate.
All right, so we've reached 42 minutes, Ron. Is there anything else that you have on your notes there that you want to say before we shut this off?
I think these are the thing we had talked about.
All right.
And again, the big picture is, again, step back and look at the big picture. That's really one of the things I bring, I think, to both parts of my job, both as an administrator and an instructor. What are the big picture and how do we fit into the big picture?
Great. Well, Ron, I want to thank you for your time today. I appreciate it. So this concludes the oral history interview with Ron Harris.